Welcome everyone. Welcome to the listening room. For the next three sessions, which we have one today and two tomorrow, we're going to talk about listening to audio documentaries. I'm told I should use this. So is this in the right place? Can you all hear me?
Okay.
You would think I would know more about microphones.
You know more than I do, so that's not saying a whole lot. Welcome. My name is Sharon, and I serve the village as education lead. Thank you for being flexible. Patricia wanted to hear Jason, and Jason wanted to hear Patricia. And this actually works out better in this room with the speaker system. So it is my pleasure to introduce Jason DeRose, Western Bureau Chief of NPR. I always want to say NPR because coming from the great state of Minnesota, M comes before N. So, and I'm going to read his quote because I love this. The title today is The Listening Room, A Sense of Place. We may live in a hyper-visual world, but the pictures are better on the radio.
Well, welcome everybody. Thank you for coming. I have done versions of this here at Holden twice before during my remediation, but I picked several different pieces, so even if you came to those, you will hear me talk about some of the similar ideas, but new pieces to listen to. I think the best way to get started listening is to listen to something. I'm going to play a short piece for you, and I want you to just think about what in this story creates the sense of place. Because it's an audio story, there aren't any pictures. So let's think through this together. And I'm going to just, after we're done listening, it's about a 3-minute piece. I just want you to start telling me what you heard that took you someplace.
Falcon, the sport of training falcons to hunt game. Considered such an important part of human history that it's now included on the UN's list of intangible cultural heritage. The ancient sport is still practiced today. Wyoming Public Radio's Molly Messick spent a day with two longtime falconers and sent us this audio poster.
Rick Sharp and Tom Meckley are standing in a wide open spot of state land. They're preparing for a hunt with the largest falcon of all, the gerfalcon. Meckley is tuning in the radio transmitter and receiver system that helps him keep track of his bird. Today, the transmitter is attached to the leg of a gray male called Rex.
Okay. So he's worried about.
Meckley has already let out his dog to start looking for game. In this area, that means Hungarian partridge or sage grouse. Before long, the dog scents a bird, and we stay as still as possible while Meckley lets his falcon fly free.
Once that bird gets in the air, the game realizes that there is a threat there.
Sharp watches as the falcon climbs up and up. All at once, the grouse flies, and Meckley shouts to his bird.
The bird dove right. Oh, it just hit the grouse. Okay, the bird's back up again.
This flight is what falconers work for. The falcon plunges from high above, targeting its prey.
And by the look of it, the grouse got grounded.
We're shielding our eyes and squinting out to see the falcon and the grouse silhouetted against the sky. The falcon chased the sage grouse into a small, rocky canyon.
Oh, you were very slow.
It's a half an hour later, and the 2-pound falcon is perched on top of the dead grouse 3 times his size.
He's not worried about eating anymore, and he's not so worried about coming home with me, so this is a little dicey right now.
Meckley is stretched out on his stomach in the dirt, trying to lure back his bird. Instead, the falcon flaps its wings and flies off.
He's eating a lot of food.
This scene is breathtaking and a little funny, but Meckley is stressed about recovering his bird. Now it's perched on a rock 50 feet away.
Looks sort of proud.
Always very proud.
We do get the falcon back, but it takes a little while. After all, it's a nearly wild bird. Falconry isn't always practiced exactly this way, but for 4,000 years, these basic elements have held true. Part of its appeal lies in witnessing something primal, the response of the prey to the falcon and the falcon to the prey. For NPR News, I'm Molly Messick.
NPR News.
So what were some of the things in that story that took you somewhere?
Sound of brush. The sound of brush, I mean, bushes or...
Bushes as they're walking through them, as the bird is flying through them. Other things?
Paul Simon, Any Saturday. There was a scene in the Masterpiece Theater, Jewel in the Crown, there was a falcon scene. So it made me think of that right away.
Other things that took you there?
Flapping of the wings.
Yeah.
Made me feel really close and tight to that bird.
Maybe one or two more? Yes?
The intensity of his voice when he was trying, when he was almost whispering. Gave you a sense of the tension.
Okay. Yes?
I appreciated at the beginning they said these two people are in a field, you know, to just kind of set the scene for us. You know?
Okay. Well, it's interesting that you brought that up, because until you brought that up, nobody had actually said any nothing that anybody said before you mentioned a description of the place.
Right.
And there's quite a lot of description in the piece. Like, they're in this field. The bird is silhouetted against the sun, but
reference
nobody.
To Wyoming. That was
yeah. But nobody. But most of you did not hear that as much as what you heard was the sound that took you there. There was an old slogan. I think it was sort of an advertising and marketing campaign for NPR a few years back that was called NPR Takes You There. And I think that we don't take you there best by describing the place. We take you there best by taking you to the place. And hopefully in this piece, it's a place that many of you, this is a holding crowd, so maybe many of you have been falconing, I don't know. But for many of our listeners, you know, the 30 million people who listen to us, most of them live, you know, sort of urban and suburban lives who probably aren't going to go falconing. So we took them to that place that they weren't going to go necessarily, maybe we're never going to get to, but eventually we took them there for just 3 minutes on a Saturday morning. I want to play another short piece for you about going somewhere. Similar, you'll notice, because I'm the Western Bureau Chief and I edit stories from Colorado to Hawaii, a lot of my pieces take place in these great, grand, wide open spaces. Now, I live in Los Angeles, and some of this is to get me at my head out of living in Los Angeles. Let me play this piece for you.
You've heard of bird watching and whale watching, but wolf watching? Well, it turns out an entire industry of tour companies has cropped up outside of Yellowstone National Park. Montana Public Radio's Dan Boyce got the chance to see and hear a wild wolf pack.
The first hints of light are just starting to brighten the morning sky as Nathan Barley and I head into Yellowstone in his black Suburban. We drive winding, snowy roads through the Blacktail Plateau.
It's a great area to hunt wolves because it's the habitat for their primary prey in the winter, which is elk and bison.
Barley grew up just outside the park, and it's here where wolves killing livestock and big game have created the passionate controversy around these animals. Barley earned his PhD studying wolves, but academia wasn't a good fit. So about 6 years ago, he started a wildlife tour company called The Wild Side.
We've been adding programs to higher volume each year than the year before.
I'm thinking this might be a good sighting for us.
We're walking up to a bluff overlooking Slough Creek. Barley directs me to a spotting scope pointing across the valley.
Look through here, you say,
Oh yeah, there's some wolves.
About a dozen, more than a half mile away.
It seems like they've already had their breakfast.
That's Englishman Darren Sanday.
Yeah.
He and his wife Beverly are here on their first winter tour of the park.
All the wolves on the hedgerows, some were still laid down. Big grey at the top of the hill, fully extended, head back, thrown back.
And then we hear it.
It's something that you will not hear as a normal day-to-day person.
It's unearthly, it's magical, it's mystical sort of sound.
And it goes through you.
And it seems to bounce off everywhere. So while they're howling, it's like nothing else goes on.
They howl for about 2 minutes. Afterward, we head back to the Suburban. Burley says his typical clients have idealized, romantic notions of wolves. They expect noble creatures that mate for life and kill only what they need.
Well, the reality is, they're top carnivores and predators, and they're effective at being that way because they're these very honed, skilled killing machines.
Nathan Barley's not romantic about wolves. He's respectful, both as a scientist and as a businessman. For NPR News, I'm Dan Boyce in Yellowstone National Park.
This is NPR News.
I always like to let the little tail of music play. I love, those are called buttons or dead rolls, and I love to let them play. Sometimes people cut them off or the local announcer speaks over it to do underwriting, but that always makes me unhappy because
I really want to have a moment to reflect on the piece I just heard. I guess if you're going from like the Supreme Court to Congress, it's fine to just jump into the next thing. But in a piece like this, you want 5 or 10 seconds to think about the piece you just heard. So what took you to that, what took you to Yellowstone?
Well, I thought it was interesting, the first sound you hear is the door closing on the car. And I didn't know what that was. I thought, is that a problem with the recording or is that? And then, but at the end, they do the same thing, the door closes on the car. So I thought, ah, there's the end and the beginning and the end. Mm-hmm. I thought that was just kind of interesting.
Yeah, we have to get you to that field and we've got to get you back from that field. So that's the technique we use to get you to and from the field.
I love the crunching of boots in the snow.
Mm-hmm.
That is.
Okay. The crunching of boots in snow?
Skiing in the Lamar Valley there, Yellowstone.
Mm-hmm.
You hear the winter skiing in the winter.
Okay. Mm. So is somebody back here have something else?
Well, again, the car,
mm-hmm.
because it legitimated that you really were taking us there.
Right.
Because I think so many times, you know, it's a play act that somebody's in the studio having a conversation with somebody when we think it's probably being telephoned in,
mm-hmm.
you know, on other snippets, but this really meant, okay, they're there.
Right, that part of the mission of my desk, the national desk, is to actually get out of the studio and to go places, to take you places. Other things that took you there?
Yeah, the howl.
Great. I was homing somebody said the main thing.
Of course.
Yes.
It's like, it's something I've never heard before. So.
Yeah. Well, again, taking you someplace that you're probably not going to go. All right, maybe we'll go to Yellowstone, but, you know, seeing something you might not be able to see or hear. I want to tell you a little story about, I edited both of these pieces that we just listened to, and with this piece, the reporter pitched this story to me before he had gone out, but he said, oh, there's this guy, and I think he's kind of interesting. Would you, like, a little profile of this guy? I said, great, yes, please go do the story, talk to him, talk to some of the tourists who, you know, he's giving tours to. He came back and he said, I said, how'd it go? And he's like, it's like a day there from where he is and a day back. So how'd it go? Great, but we didn't hear any wolves. And I said, well, then you don't have a story. Because the payoff for this story is the wolves. And if the wolves aren't there, what am I going to do? Say, well, we went and we couldn't find any wolves. Well, I said, go back. Keep going back until you find some wolves. because, you know, it was a very sort of heady theoretical story until then. It was, oh, this guy started this business. And was it going to be a business story? Was it going to be a nature story? It ends up being a combination of the two. But without the wolves, like, that's the total payoff. And, you know, now thinking back on this story, I think I edited this 5 or 6 years ago, I think I would have kept the wolves up in the clear a little longer without the people talking over it. I wanted the people to talk over it, but I also wanted more of the wolves up in the clear. Again, this piece was 2 minutes and 45 seconds, so we had to do a lot of compression. Similar with the falconry story. You'll notice that she gives it various time posts throughout that piece. You know, it's this time in the morning, the sun is here, now the sun is in the afternoon, it's 30 minutes later, we've been trying to get the bird back for an hour. And she was out there for like about 10 hours and gathered 10 hours of tape and compressed it into 2 minutes and 45 seconds. So I know that, you know, there's a lot of sort of bad lip service being given to journalists of all sorts, not just fake news. but that, you know, we are manipulating or controlling the story, and that is in fact entirely true. We manipulate and control the whole story because we spent a day reporting something so that you didn't have to spend a day hanging out with, you know, 6 hours and 45 minutes of it. Nothing happened that day. What we do is compress it into this nugget that you can hear, and with NPR, I hope you trust us to tell the story that is true. It's not everything. You don't want to listen to 9 hours of this. You want to listen to a few minutes of it. One other thing about the falconry story. When this reporter, she was a very young reporter when she pitched this story to me. She's now actually quite advanced, was a producer on Morning Edition for several years and is now running her own podcast. She pitched me this story as, they're gonna name falconry one of the intangible cultural heritages of the world. Do you want a story about that? And I said, yeah, that sounds interesting. Like, who would you talk to? And she had like an anthropologist, and she had somebody from the UN talking about what an intangible cultural heritage meant. And I said, you are describing such an incredibly boring story about something that is actually interesting. Like, why would you take something that's like, I didn't actually know that people still hunted with falcons. I had no idea how it worked. My only relationship to falcons was like the opening credits of Falcon Crest was like there was a little falcon. But I didn't know that people still did this. So I said, you know, let's just put like the news in the intro. The UN is naming this important cultural heritage. But why don't we just actually tell people why it's interesting to still pay attention to? It's hard. You've got to train this bird. You spend all day. Now, actually, luckily, they don't rely on falconry for, you know, either feeding themselves or making a living, because if it takes all day to get one bird, it's probably not the most remunerative form of work. Other things that you thought of when listening to that story that took you somewhere?
I'm curious about the choice of the dobro playing a bit of Amazing Grace, How Sweet the Sound at the end.
Oh, at the end, okay. So that's not actually my choice, that's the director's choice. I've actually, because I also edit religion, and we're going to play some religion pieces in a bit, I get very nervous about too much hymnody being played after some of my pieces. I feel like it might be the director is not quite being as, I call it classy with a K, when they decide to like play a hymn after a religion piece. Or you'll probably notice that I do very few pieces about Islam that involve a call to prayer, because I think it's just, it is a hackneyed piece of sound in the same way that an expression or a turn of phrase can be hackneyed in a story. Yes?
Yeah, there's Wolfhaven about 10 miles south of Olympia. Mm-hmm. And they used to have Friday night howlings. I haven't been there for quite a number of years. But it was interesting that I understand that how exhausting for the wolves. You know, and so they only start to howl in like every half hour or 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it took me right there.
Mm-hmm. One thing that... did you have...
Yeah, just that there were other people there that had British accents.
Mm-hmm. This was about to be my point.
Yeah.
That they came from far, far away to hear this. And there were... I'm not sure that... Can you name a national park in Great Britain? I can't. But that people would know that they could come to Yellowstone and go on, to even think to go on a wolf listening tour. Okay, I'm going to play. You'll notice that these sessions have a lot of playing of pieces. So I apologize if I'm not talking as much as you'd like me to, but a lot of work went into making these pieces, and I want you to actually hear them, and hopefully they will take you somewhere. Now, here is a story about a place some of you will be familiar with.
Now to a tiny village here in the U.S. attempting to solve an environmental challenge. Nestled in a remote valley in Washington's Cascade Mountains, Holden Village is about to be flooded with hundreds of workers there to clean up the contaminated remains of an old copper mine. Anna King of the Northwest News Network reports on what the cleanup will cost the town.
To understand how hard it'll be to clean up this copper mine, first, you have to understand how hard it is to get there. From Seattle, it's a 3-hour drive east. Then, a 3-hour boat ride up Lake Chelan. Norm Day is the U.S. Forest Service manager heading the mine cleanup.
Forest Service departing Lucerne for Holden Village.
He drags the last leg of the journey up 12 miles of heart-in-the-throat switchbacks. Around the final corner, Holden Village looks like one of those old-timey Christmas cards. Four steep peaks hug the valley. There are snow-dusted chalets, a tiny school, all built in 1937. But just beyond this picturesque place up Copper Mountain, Norm Day points out the problem, the leftovers from 2 decades of mining.
This water coming out of the mine has a lot of the heavy metals and is pretty contaminated water.
At the mouth of the old mine, water flows out from underneath padlocked, corrugated metal doors.
Whoa! That is one of the creepiest things I've ever seen.
There's about 60 miles of pitch black tunnel down there, half underwater. All that rock was either reduced down into copper and other metals or discarded as rust-colored dust and black slime. There are several 12-story piles of that toxic guff just outside the mine. Water picks up heavy metals as it runs through these piles before heading into nearby Railroad Creek. It's bad for the things fish eat and for the fish themselves. The plan is to build underground concrete barriers, some down 80 feet to bedrock.
We're trying to create a bathtub effect here where we can collect all the dirty water, so to speak, and then run it through a treatment process to clean the water up again.
A massive company called Rio Tinto now owns the mine. Managers wouldn't speak on tape, but did provide a written statement saying, Rio Tinto didn't create this mess. Rather, it inherited the cleanup responsibility through a series of acquisitions. The current plan calls for about $100 million. But the cleanup will cost more than just money. After the mine closed in 1957, the camp became a Lutheran retreat center. The year-round staff was about 60. The population swells to about 400 in the summers. For half a century, Vesper services, matins, Bible studies, and weaving classes have all been announced with a bell. What's new this fall is the addition of about 60 mine cleanup workers. Convoys of dump trucks and other heavy equipment roll through town where there once were just convoys of deer. Every piece of equipment has to be brought in by barge. Just as the traffic is alien to the village, village life is alien to truck driver Lena Barron.
I've never been that close to a deer without eating it. You know what I mean? Even the squirrels, it's just a peaceful feeling.
But that peace will be interrupted even more in the coming years. By the spring of 2013, as many as 400 mine cleanup workers will arrive at Holden for a 2-year stint. There won't be room for both the workers and the retreat center's regular guests, which raises concerns about Holden's survival. It'll have to be mostly closed down during that time. Chuck and Stephanie Carpenter are the village's co-directors. Stephanie says Lutherans are hardy, and they've got work projects of their own. And she says there are many people around the world watching out for Holden.
Chuck and I, and anyone who works here, we're buoyed up by this huge, huge body of people who are paying attention to this little teeny village in the middle of the wilderness.
Even now, there's a careful truce between the villagers in tie-dye and crew members in bright orange vests. People in hand-knit caps looking for spiritual renewal mingle with wage earners and hard hats. Some of the workers can't wait to get on a plane back home after their 3-week rotations in town, but others start to blend in. Stephanie Carpenter recalls when 3 mine cleanup managers arrived in pinstripes.
And one day they come walking into the dining hall and they had gone to the tie-dye class and tie-dyed their pinstripe office shirts. And they're like, oh yeah, we're going to wear them into the office on Monday morning.
But Chuck says Holden life has led to much more than just a change of clothing for some.
We have breakfast together, sometimes have a cup of coffee with someone. And it's great listening to their stories and hearing their stories of discovering this place and discovering what it's doing in their lives.
Holden Village is a place of renewal where people come to rest, reflect, and in some cases heal. Now the village believes, despite the burden of cleanup, that nearby Copper Mountain and Railroad Creek deserve a time of rest and renewal as well. For NPR News, I'm Anna King.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
So what took you there? Well, maybe a better question for this story. I was actually slightly nervous about playing this story because rarely am I sitting in front of the people that we've reported on when I'm doing the story. Just a little bit of background on this. I came up here for the first time in the fall of 2011 as part of a St. Olaf College alumni group, and we sat around here and read short stories together. And I learned about this cleanup, and I thought this would make a really interesting story. So I sent reporter Anna King up here to do that story, and this is the piece that resulted in that. So maybe the better question is, did I get the place right? I'd only been here once, and she was only here once.
So I'm going to turn that back around on you. Having been here a handful of times more and spent more time in the village, do you feel like listening to that now, you've captured the place, or what would you change about the editing of that piece now that you've spent more time here and seen different seasons of the village?
That's a good question. Overall, I'm happy with it. I'm actually surprised at how well we did capture things from just my 1 week or 10 days here and her 48 hours in town. But I had talked to a ton of people. And you can tell, like, I had a heavy hand in writing this piece. So this was not mostly her writing. This was a lot of, like, both of us together writing the story. Anna's a great reporter. But I think she's a much more hard news reporter. So here's my criticism of this piece, and I mentioned this to you earlier, is that it is not hard enough. You know, Rio Tinto wouldn't talk to us for the story. I still think there are real questions about how much it was supposed to cost and how much it did cost. And I have really interesting questions to still ask about, like, was it worth it? And what if they have to finish the wall in another 5 years? So I keep thinking, like, should I send Anna back up here to do a story? And at this point, I want to, but I'm too close to the village now to edit that story, so I would probably hand it off to somebody else who isn't as involved in this place. Like, back then, I was a guest once, and I felt like I could still have a lot of critical distance.
When did it air?
So I was here in October of 2011. It probably aired in November of 2011.
So this was really before.
It was when that small group of just 60 people were up here.
Come up, right. Yeah. So that's important because it was probably pretty different, like, you know, a year later.
She and I had talked about the idea of her coming up while it was going on, and I thought, we've already got 6 minutes of national real estate here. Can I really, like, argue for following this one case all the way through? There are actually bigger, more important environmental disasters to report on.
One other thing I just was thinking about, I thought it was fabulous, I love the story, but yep. I was thinking about, you know, something that you have to make choices about what you put into it, but like the possibility of talking to just a church person who'd been coming up here mm-hmm. for years. Because it sounds a little like, you know, the tie-dye hippie thing, you know. I mean, and Holden's a lot more than that in terms of who comes, you know. So if I was hearing it without knowing this place, I'd think, oh, you know, like, you know, I wouldn't know that there'd be somebody, you know.
I think if I could change it, and if I could have maybe gotten another minute or two into the story, yeah. I would have probably wanted to talk to some guests who were here.
Yeah.
But I think that's one of the most difficult things that most of us find when we leave the village. How do you explain the village? Because, yeah, some people we know think it's a cult, and some think it's a Bible camp. And so, you know, it's interesting listening to that because, you know, I can feel the things I think were left out or whatever, but I think it is hard to capture a place that is somewhat unique.
Well, I want to hear what you think was left out. My direction to Anna was, you have to have some music, some of Vespers in the piece, just because I love that music and I want to put it on the air. And you have to mention the tie-dye, because I have to say, just as someone who had never been here before, I had never seen so much tie-dye in my life. But it's not the only thing she talks about. What would be some of the things that you would have wanted included in the piece that you think would have helped listeners come here who'd never been here? Or not come here physically, but what would have helped the story bring listeners here?
Little kids all the way up through old people.
Okay.
I mean, just sort of the disparity of all the folks that show up.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And international.
Okay. International.
Come here from all over the world, not just Minnesota and the local.
Right. A couple,
you know, challenging presentations or topics. So just, you know, to mention, people are up here grappling with, you know, I mean, now we'd say, you know, climate change or you know, what, you know, what we should do about, you know, LGBT or what, you know, and just a sprinkling of that. Mm-hmm. So that people think it's not just kind of...
Talk more about the educational programs. Yeah, I think I totally agree. I think we should have probably put that in the story.
But she was here in the winter, which is a very different experience than the summer.
Right.
So those things almost are more summerish. She wouldn't have seen her. That wouldn't have been the slice of home that she saw.
The trick with this story is that because it's so hard to get to, especially in the winter, she didn't come up the way most of us came up here. She got the Forest Service to, like, drive her on a boat by herself with the other guy. Like, that was it. There was two of them on a boat all the way up here. So it was a slightly different experience. And the reason that the top of the story is framed the way it is, the Forest Service person is her guide into the village. And I think you hear about the village differently if you're with the Forest Service. Then if we had put her on the slow boat from Chelan that had, you know, she had to go up the switchbacks, clearly, but she didn't take the buses up, so.
I think the other thing that's really interesting about the two stories together, you know, you didn't get any criticisms on the first story, right? Because you created the image for us and we didn't know anything about it.
Right.
And so we filled in all the details ourselves and we have an image of what that's like, and if we went and actually visited it, I mean, it's just an interesting problem that I guess you grapple with all the time in terms of, you know, because you give people enough that they can fill in the details and get things that they, you know, I'm sure I wouldn't have gotten a lot of what was in that first story if I'd been there to see it.
Right.
And it's a fascinating problem.
Well, remember what I said is that, you know, she spent a whole day to compress down to 2 minutes and 45 seconds. Many of you have been coming here 50, 60, 70 years of your life, and we're trying to compress that down into just 6 minutes on the radio.
I think that inclusive sense of community, of welcoming sense of community, that no matter when you come or who you are, it's just part of the culture.
That we should have worked harder to include that in the story.
Well, and you almost have to be here longer to get that.
I mean, I think that the tie-dye story.
Right. So you did get the feeling of community and the way people talk about eating together. Part that was missing, as you say, is the summer part where you have all these sessions of learning and dialogue about relevancy today, right, that you don't have when it's a smaller.
Okay, now here's what I find interesting about everything you've all said. None of you mentioned any of the natural sounds in this story. Like, you're all talking about the things because you know so much about this place, but none of you mentioned the bell or the vespers or the boat or the clanging of the corrugated metal door. Oh, right. Yes, Chuck.
I was going to say, what I found interesting about it, and yes, I would invite you to do another sequel to that, but that having Peg and I have dealt with that, I think what you kind of got at too was just the paradox or the tension between a mining company whose life is about profit and moving earth around, and a village center that really kind of talks about how to live quietly in nature, right? So there couldn't be more opposite.
Right. So the whole first half
of that tension.
Right.
Yeah, it was really good, and I thought you captured that. I like the music at the end. Is there something a little bit that kind of conjured that up for me with sound?
So the whole first half of the piece doesn't even mention that there's a thing called Holden. Well, it mentions Holden Village, but it doesn't mention that there's this actual group of people who live here doing something all year long. The first 2.5 minutes of the piece it sounds like it's this environmental reclamation job. And the thing that I think injects the interesting tension into the story, actually our third session is going to be about tension and conflict. So all of these could be used in all of those. Any piece that I play could be used in any of these sessions. So they're cumulative if you come to all three. But you know, you don't hear about the village until halfway through the piece. So I, you know, I, I think I wanted it, so I personally think that a lot of people, if you say, and now we're going to tell you a religion story, aren't going to listen to the story. Just knowing the NPR audience, they tend to be very interested in environmental stories, and so I was trying to get you into that through a side door. Yes?
I was on the same wavelength because I really liked the juxtaposition that she presented when she would present the hard hats and the knit caps or whatever.
Convoys of trucks and convoys of beer. I think it's a great line.
I like stories and I teach English, so I just really like the verb choices and all of the, just the narrative verbs and you chose, you said you wrote it with her to present it. So when we were last here in 2012 when that small group of miners had started, so I could envision the dining hall what she was describing. So I thought that was spot on actually for that part.
I could have added one more thing into the piece that would be relevant when Anna was here, but not now, is the old collapsing mill structure up on the mountainside and the girders and the broken windows in contrast to the village, which is really well kept and grassy and flowers and the structures are really well maintained. And when you talk about the juxtaposition of the legacy of the mine is this village, but there was this visual reminder up on the hill of this thing that was slowly just disintegrating. That was always something that I noticed when I came to the village was there's this, you get up on the hill and you look down and you see manicured lawns and rose beds and people kind of buzzing around this really beautiful place. And then you turn around and you see one of the ugliest sights that you're ever going to see.
I think that structure had already been taken down by the time she got here, because I was actually here on the day it came down in October of that year. So she didn't get a chance to quite see that, the high juxtaposition.
Having listened to the wolf story ahead of this was really interesting for me because I was like thinking that we were the wolves, you know? Like, and I thought that they could have... Well, just that we're the kind of curiosity, like it kind of gets planted at the beginning, like there's this village here and there's people that live here. But I think as a listener, you'd be like, well, who lives there? what is that? And I think that could have gotten played out a little bit more, like the curiosity of, like, who is living here?
Right.
And maybe a little more emphasis that it's a group of Christians that really care about the environment, you know, as an emphasis. Those are the two things that I was thinking of.
Yeah, I think that's a good criticism of the piece.
I thought it was interesting. A couple times she described it as a town, and I never think of Holden as a town.
Yeah.
I think of it as a village.
She says retreat center and town sort of interchangeably, and we talked about how to describe it. And I said you could spend 5 minutes just trying to describe what it is. Mm-hmm. So we sort of specifically picked those two words to use interchangeably, so that people would get a sense that it's kind of a town. But it's also a retreat center. Yes?
I appreciate at the beginning, you said it's 3 hours from Seattle, you hear the boat starting, and then you hear them radioing that they're going to go up on the bus. So in a very small amount of time, you clued me in that it's not easy to get here.
Yeah.
We took a short amount of time to explain that it was going to be difficult for the mine to bring all their equipment up and do whatever they needed to do.
Right. I mean, that was Anna's first impression when I assigned her to do this story. I said, "Now it's not going to be easy to get to." And she's like, "Oh no, that's not a problem. I'm used to driving all over Washington State." And she's the central Washington correspondent for the Northwest News Network. So she has a big swath of land that she covers. And then when she called me after she was up here, she was like, "You were not kidding how hard that place is to get to."
But
it's
such a short amount of time. Yeah. You really
Yeah,
I don't know if they mentioned the value of the copper they took out, $60 million, then
no.
Today's dollar, $600 million.
Right, we did not mention that in the story.
Reclamation.
Right. Well, we didn't know how much it was going to be. Like, remember, we said the only number in the story. Well, there are several numbers.
Million.
Right. The number, because that was the number that was being used at that time.
Yeah.
What I would want to do in this, if I were to do another story about this, it would totally be the 500 and whatever, 60 million or whatever that number is, and comparing that to what they thought it was going to cost, but also like how much copper came out of that mine in the first place, and was it basically a wash, you know, for the world?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But people don't always understand, you know, the impact of those heavy metals, you know, on the lake. And, you know, people say, oh, all that money could have been spent on education or this or that. Or, but, you know, the long-term effect of those heavy metals.
You'll notice that she compresses the whole controversy about whether or not what was going on was environmentally problematic into like two sentences, which is, it's, you know, bad for the fish and the stuff the fish eat. Like, that's in part because I think I didn't want to get into, there's so many little like avenues we could have gone down in the story. It's a whole story of whether like it was worth doing or not. I will also say, nobody in the piece was in the story. Like, there was a lot of reluctance from the village to be like clear with us about what was going on, and I was frustrated as a journalist. I was like, why can't I get a straight answer from the village or from Rio Tinto? The Forest Service was actually the only forthcoming people in this entire story, so that was a frustration of mine. But now I think that the village didn't like know everything, but I was also just like, give me some facts to hang this on. Because I love the tie-dye story, but the tie-dye story is not, it's a story. It's not like some facts that we can think about.
And it took twice as long. I mean, it's in, you know, 2 years.
Right, it's supposed to be 2 years, right.
It's more than 2 years.
Okay, I think you're convincing me that there's a follow-up story. But now I've got to find an editor who's willing to, is interested in it enough to do it, because I think Anna would be great at it. I think I know who that editor is. Okay.
I think we're also telling you that we want a documentary. I mean,
What you want is like a 55-year long documentary.
And the aftermath from the fire, like to see you cover that.
Yeah. I think the fire would be an interesting story to tell. Just as the Western bureau chief, we tell so many fire stories that I end up like, how many more fire stories can we tell? Because everyone is interesting, but if we could literally put a fire story piece a day on Morning Edition and All Things Considered, and I think that people would just get really sick of them, and then they wouldn't have as much of an impact because if you heard it every day. So Anna did a great fire story for me a couple of years ago. It was about how you evacuate cattle during a wildfire.
Yes.
I think she actually won an award for that piece, but it was like a way to get people interested in a fire story, which was, oh, if you've got thousands of head of cattle out there, how do you move thousands of head of cattle? So
I wrote a part about that I just learned on this trip that back in the days when they were pulling the stuff out of the mine, the families that were here spent time talking. Because one of the people we have here, you maybe had a chance to meet her, a little girl grew up here, and she's been very involved with helping us know that she remembers the adults sitting around worrying about how it was causing damage to the fish. There was an environmental discussion way back then when they were pulling it out, but the war was going on, and the war needed the copper, and that was the priority. I found that very interesting with what we're now trying to do about the environment.
Yeah, I understand that she led some sessions here a couple of weeks ago.
On your point, too, a Mennonite who was up here recently pointed out that it's the continuous cost of war, that the cleanup was another $500 million that was part of the war effort during World War II, but the ramifications of
that's a really interesting story. That is a great environmental story. Actually, that would be a great story for Anna, because, you know, Anna is like the person in the United States who covers the Hanford Reservation. And so she knows, she's also married to a nuclear physicist, so it's very helpful for her to, I mean, he is helpful to get the story. He can say, oh, that thing that just happened the other day, that's really serious, or that's not that serious. So.
And just to add on to that, living in Tacoma, the ASARCO plant where most of this copper was smelted was brought down, cleaned up, and is now, it's like condos and restaurants and one of the fastest growing places in Tacoma if you want some real estate. But when you talk about that, there was affecting 250,000 people in the Tacoma region, got cleaned up much faster, much more focus, much more emphasis than this end of the copper pipeline. But even with that, there's ongoing environmental impacts, again, the ongoing cost of war. Mm-hmm. Like you go to the beaches in Tacoma and there are signs telling you, make sure you wash your hands after playing the sand because it's full of heavy metals.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, you should just quickly, I want to play one more piece for you, which is very different from these others. But we have actually been developing over the last few years a very large team of people who cover environment and energy, led by some staff reporters, but also in conjunction with member station reporters around the country, Anna among them. And so you will hear many more stories about this, probably not tons more about Holden, but you know, we've done many of these cleanup stories and what it really costs. I want to play, just as our closing thought before we all head off to dinner, a very different sort of story about place. These first three stories I edited myself. They're all out of the West. They have a very me sensibility to them, I think. This piece, I had nothing to do with. It aired while I was in college. I was hoping to do something like this thing someday. And I'm not going to play, this is a 22-minute documentary, and I'm only going to play the first 4 or 5 minutes of it for you, and there's a place where it actually ends. But later I will tell you how to find the whole documentary online if you'd like to listen to it. That is all I'm going to say because there's an introduction on here.
This is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Times Square is a special spot of Midtown Manhattan. It teems with people, countless thousands of them, day and night. They're commuters, shoppers, theatergoers, merchants, prostitutes, and policemen, hardened New Yorkers, and wide-eyed tourists. Times Square is a swirl of images. The anxious crowds gathering around a moving news ticker in times of tragedy, the sailor joyously kissing a young woman amidst the tumult of VJ Day, and as always, the lights. Flashing signs, huge billboards, the garish neon. 2 years ago, a photographer named Richard Sandler began a project taking pictures of the signs and the lights, but it wasn't long before his focus began to shift from the sights to the sounds of the multitudes of religious believers who were also drawn to Times Square. He switched from a still camera to a video camera and a microphone. And he began to record the preachers and missionaries who've made a portion of Times Square their dominion. Richard Sandler takes us along now on his journey among the gods of Times Square, produced for radio by David Isay. He has power over us. He knows that we carry an ancient memory of times ages ago when any human likeness this large was a representation of the deity.
Why does everyone hate us group preacher who preaches truth for free for you?
I wish I could fire up a time travel machine and transport to Times Square an ordinary Joe from Nebuchadnezzar's day and place him in the middle of this temple to consumerism, pornography, and the secular life. I imagine he would be frightened and awed by the sight of these huge and radiant images all around, but I have no doubt he would take a picture of Marky Mark with his drawers pulled down and Kate Moss, her hand poised on the elastic of his underpants, as God and Goddess, and pay them their obeisant due. His prayer would be one more voice in a chorus of zealots,
Why is it that Times Square is a mecca for modern-day religious pilgrims who come to this place to inquire into the nature of God, to argue, to pray, to convert? I know something persistent and powerful drew me there to discover the gods of Times Square.
So that's about the first 5 minutes of a 22-minute piece. If you want to listen to the whole piece, not while you're here. You can go to the website soundportraits.org and listen to The Gods of Times Square. So what takes you this, I should tell you, the rest of the documentary turns into a meditation on how we interact with street preachers. So it's a great piece. I think it's a really good piece. But what takes you there? Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. You can just yell out, turn on the mic.
The cacophony of it, I mean, just the,
yeah.
Not all, much of it not comprehensible.
Right, right. You're hearing, you know, hundreds of people talking, screaming, dozens of people preaching all at once.
Car horns. Mm-hmm. Car horns, yeah.
I like that it doesn't distinguish the preacher voice from the advertising voice.
Okay. Okay. That's an interesting contrast. I love the he does this amazing piece of writing at the top, which is why I'd like to play this section of this documentary, where he's talking about the Colossus of Marky Mark, and how Marky Mark and Kate Moss, if you know, a person from Nebuchadnezzar's time would say, oh, those must be the deities here, and he's right, isn't he? He's right. Did somebody else have their hand up already?
Well, there were many languages and accents, like, mm-hmm. you know, that you could distinguish. It wasn't just a white preacher talking.
Right. Well, it's Times Square, and so it's a very. Now, what's interesting about this piece, and I would love for Sandler to go back and do one now, because this is he produced this in the early '90s, I believe. This aired in '94. I think it aired on Christmas Eve, 1994, I think, because I remember I was in college when I heard it, and that Times Square has so dramatically changed. In large part because of Giuliani and what's his name, Bloomberg, that you know, it's now a mall basically, and like it's not unlike the Mall of America. I was there recently, and I was like, well, it's like the Mall of America without a roof, you know. So, other things that took you there. Was there any one? I'm sorry.
I liked the list. I broke down the hardened residents and the wide-eyed tourists. Mm-hmm. He had several of those I couldn't write fast enough.
Right, right.
He went back and forth, you know. But
contrast.
And that brings you to Times Square, because if you're going to write that scene and list other places, you wouldn't choose some of those same words. So that was uniquely a big city and uniquely New York.
So this section that I played to you, I think of as the prelude. It's the overture to the piece, because he hints at themes, and you hear from preachers in this cacophony that he actually goes and investigates and interviews like almost everybody that you hear in that 5 minute segment. He comes back to and spends a couple of minutes with each of them to introduce you to the various street preachers. I mean, he spent years producing this.
The tension in that piece, it was almost overwhelming.
Well, I think that he's doing a couple of things. He's trying to overwhelm you because he wants to take you to what it is actually like to be in Times Square. But then he does this very other radio maneuver, which is to like take you to the place, you're suddenly overwhelmed by all of the aural experiences of the place. And then he's going to like, what you heard at the very end there was like, he's fading everything out. And now, so that first scene is like the wide shot. As you said, the pictures are better on the radio. That first scene is a wide shot where you can see everything going on at once, and it's kind of overwhelming. And the rest of the piece is these little close-ups of the various preachers. And I mean, and it's not just it's all kinds of preachers. I mean, you meet someone who's a Scientologist who's there. You meet a Mooney who's there. You meet lots of different people.
Growing up in New Jersey, my first visits were during the '40s, where we would take a bus across the river once or twice a year, and what I heard were the combination as a kid of absolutely thrilling and captivating and dirty.
Dirty.
Oh, yeah.
You mentioned Bloomberg and Giuliani changing things. How has it changed from what we heard?
Well, I mean, Times Square in this era was dirty. Mm-hmm. I mean, and if you listen to Robert at the top of the piece, what he's describing is, like, it's the place where, like, the porn theaters are. It's the place where the prostitutes are. It was not a nice shopping mall like place. Not, I don't think shopping malls are nice, so don't get me wrong there. But I actually have been to Times Square in both eras and thought the earlier one that he's describing is much more interesting. This actually gets me to a point I want to make about taking you places you may never go, because none of us can go to that place anymore, because that place doesn't exist anymore. So part of what he's doing with this documentary is creating a document of that moment in time, the early 90s when he was there. Now, we didn't know when we were broadcasting this that it would be a very different place 25 years later. But now it exists as, it can take you to a place not only that you might never go to, it takes you to a place you can never ever go to because it's not there anymore.
There's something interesting listening to that piece here, too. Like, if I was, you know, driving to work and listening to that, I actually live in New Jersey, so I think I'd have a different reaction to it because I am so familiar with the current New York City than here when I'm just kind of calm and serene, and that really made me anxious.
Listening to the piece made you anxious.
Yeah.
It was designed to. The reason I played the first three pieces first and then this one last is that I wanted to talk about going to different kinds of places. I also think, you know, right now we're doing a ton of reporting about, like, urban-rural divides and people from different parts of the country and different backgrounds understanding or not understanding each other. And I think that part of what we can do in taking you there is to take you to places that are not just not physically where you are, but not in any way where you are. And we'll talk a little bit more about that tomorrow as well. And I'll have a little more. This is just like the foretaste of what's to come tomorrow. Tomorrow I'm going to talk a little bit more about putting sort of a slightly more philosophical framework on this, although I don't ever want to be accused of being a philosopher of media theory or something like that, because that is not what I am. I'm a journalist, and I just like making radio. So thank you all so much for coming, and we'll see you tomorrow. So the next session is tomorrow morning at, I think, 11-ish. Just check the schedule, and then the third and final session will be tomorrow afternoon at the same time that this one was today at 4 o'clock. Great, thank you again.